From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At a White House news conference this afternoon, President Bush criticized the latest Israeli military assault on Palestinian targets in the West Bank. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
President Bush's comments come as Vice President Cheney tours the Middle East. The president was asked about the Israeli offensive in Ramallah and its impact on administration efforts to get a ceasefire in place.
Frankly, it's not helpful what the Israelis have recently done in order to create conditions for peace. I understand someone trying to defend themselves and to fight terror, but the recent actions aren't helpful.
The president said the Middle East is an issue that is consuming a lot of time for his administration. The past year and a half have brought increasing violence to the region. In addition to Cheney's visit there, presidential envoy Anthony Zinni is also now on his way to Jerusalem to try to find a way to mediate the conflict. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Secretary of Defense Donna Rumsfeld says there most likely will be a legally binding document tying Russia and the United States to a promise to cut long-range nuclear weapons by two-thirds. Russia's defense minister has been in Washington for 2 days of talks with Pentagon officials. The Russian official said today that he would like to see enough progress made so that a document could be signed at a Moscow summit in May. Senators from oil-producing and automaking states today won their fight for approval of an industry-friendly measure that leaves raising fuel efficiency standards to the Transportation Department. The vote today dimmed prospects for a rival measure that would hike average gas mileage requirements by 50% over a decade. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The Senate voted 62-38 in favor of an amendment to an energy bill that effectively delays any possible hike in fuel efficiency requirements. While the measure asks the Transportation Department to spend up to 2 years determining new corporate average fuel efficiency, or CAFE, standards, it makes no recommendations how high those standards should be raised. The current standard of about 24 miles per gallon has not been changed for more than a quarter century. The vote made approval highly unlikely for a rival proposal that boosts CAFE standards to 36 miles per gallon over the next 13 years. Proponents said this would cut oil imports by 1 million barrels a day, but opponents argued such an increase in CAFE standards would mean smaller and more unsafe vehicles. They also warned it could drive U.S. auto plants out of business. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In Atlanta, a jury has decided that former 60s radical H-Rap Brown should serve life in prison without parole for the murder of a sheriff's deputy. The jury in the trial of Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin could have decided that he be executed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 130 points. NASDAQ was down by 35. This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Susan Stamberg. Mop-up operations are underway in the Shaiko Mountains of eastern Afghanistan. For more than a week, a U.S.-led coalition of American and Afghan troops has fought an intense battle against al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters hidden in mountain caves. Today, a U.S. military spokesman called the operation a great success. From eastern Afghanistan, NPR's Ivan Watson reports.
Standing beside a makeshift helicopter pad at the foot of the Shaiko Mountains, General Ziauddin announced that al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters here were all but defeated. Speaking through a translator, Ziauddin, the commander of the local Afghan militia, said his men were now searching for enemy bodies.
Resistance is finished right now. Just we are searching some caves and also other places, especially canyons, to find them where they are right now.
The U.S. military and its Afghan allies say they haven't seen sustained resistance from al-Qaeda here for more than 5 days. Still, their forces aren't taking any chances. While refueling here, five American helicopters, including one of the large double-rotored CH-47 Chinooks used for troop transport, were protected by two Apache attack helicopters circling overhead. The Apaches periodically swooped low to the ground to investigate approaching vehicles. Later, General Ziauddin led a seven-truck convoy on patrol. The trucks bounced over arid foothills beneath the peaks where most of this month's fighting has taken place. Dozens of U.S.-trained Afghan soldiers in the convoy were on high alert. U.S. Special Forces were also traveling with the Afghans. When the vehicles stopped, the bearded Americans took up protective positions at the front and the back of the group. Clouds of smoke and dust periodically mushroomed up from the neighboring mountains. Either the choppers or troops on the ground were setting off massive explosions. A farmer named Mirajan said he and his family were terrified by the fighting. Children have fled here from their houses in the mountains, he said. They think the bombing has destroyed their homes and killed their parents. The U.S.-led coalition began its assault here on March 2nd. The attack was codenamed Operation Anaconda, and it relied on 1,000 American troops as well as hundreds of local Afghan fighters. The coalition was trying to knock out an al-Qaeda force estimated at anywhere from 150 to more than 1,000 men. The Pentagon claims its airstrikes have killed hundreds of al-Qaeda fighters. But General Ziauddin says he's only seen 8 or 10 enemy bodies, and his deputy, Mohammed Ismail, says they've only captured 4 prisoners. At least 200 al-Qaeda fighters escaped, Ismail says. The border to Pakistan is very close, and the villagers around here are Taliban supporters. If you had 10,000 soldiers, you still couldn't secure this area. A man who simply calls himself Jack and who claims to be an advisor to the Northern Alliance also believes most of the enemy here escaped. He says local commanders sold out their U.S. allies by allowing this to happen.
In Tora Bora, tons of al-Qaeda and Taliban escaped across the border. In Kandahar, thousands escaped across the border into Pakistan through Spinbaldak. They did nothing to stop them. So if you look at here, unfortunately, it's a little too late.
The U.S. is calling Operation Anaconda a success. The same was said about the similar Battle of Tora Bora last December. In Tora Bora, much like in Shaiko, al-Qaeda fighters fiercely defended themselves in a network of mountain caves. In both cases, intense airstrikes coupled with ground assaults drove the defenders from the region. And in both battles, there was little evidence of serious al-Qaeda casualties. Ivan Watson, NPR News in the Shaiko Mountains of eastern Afghanistan.
Robert Mugabe secured a fifth term in office today when he was declared the winner in Zimbabwe's fiercest fought presidential election yet. Mugabe's challenger, Morgan Tsvangirai, called the result daylight robbery. And in Washington, President Bush described the election as flawed and said the United States does not recognize the outcome of the vote. But African countries are closing ranks behind Mugabe. From Johannesburg, NPR's Judy McCarthy reports.
The victory extends Mugabe's monopoly on power another 6 years. According to government returns, he won 56% of the vote to opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai's 41%. But Tsvangirai was having none of it.
The biggest electoral fraud I've ever witnessed in my life. But the people of Zimbabwe know better that this election does not reflect the true will of the people of Zimbabwe and are consequently illegitimate in the eyes of the people.
The man who gave Mugabe his most serious challenge in 2 decades accused him of destroying a once prosperous country and trampling the rights of those who dared oppose him. For all Tsvangirai's troubles, senior members of his Movement for Democratic Change now face charges of treason. Soldiers surrounded the MDC headquarters in the city of Bulawayo today, as a military presence built up in other cities. Yet Tsvangirai said his party does not accept the election of Mugabe, but he was vague about possible next steps.
We seek no confrontation with the state, because that's what it is looking for, but it is the people themselves who will have to decide what form of action to take.
Mugabe fought this election campaign on the promise of confiscating white-owned farmland for landless black farmers. His policy has encouraged unemployed veterans from the War for Independence to seize and occupy white-owned farms. Justice Minister Patrick Chinamosa said the election was a vote in favor of the land redistribution.
We went to the people to seek their mandate for us to complete the unfinished business of the Liberation War. And it looks like that they are going to give us a firm mandate to complete that task.
Independent observers said the outcome was more likely a product of rigging and months of intimidation. The few Western monitors who were allowed in also said a deliberate ploy to provide too few polling stations meant thousands lost the chance to vote. European governments concluded the ballot had been far from free and fair. Speaking in South Africa, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Walter Kansteiner, called the election fundamentally flawed.
Supreme Court rulings in Zimbabwe were cast aside. The Constitution was flaunted. The independent media was persecuted. Civil society was marginalized. And the will of the people was the chief casualty.
The U.S. State Department later urged other African states to speak up for the rule of law and democratic principles. A rift has emerged between the West and many African governments over their continued defense of Mugabe. Nigeria and Kenya sent him congratulations today. And South Africa declared that while the voting process had flaws, the result was still legitimate. Samuel Musinyane led the South African monitors.
The people of Zimbabwe really came in their numbers to express their will through the ballot box. The opposition party participated in the campaigning, which in our minds legitimized their involvement in that process. And the whole process proceeded relatively peacefully.
Mugabe's government was making no apologies either. The Home Affairs Minister said, "The recent election in the United States wasn't our business, and so why should the international community be concerned about Zimbabwe?" Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Johannesburg.
It points once again to the need to have a complete overhaul, a complete reorganization of the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Paperwork on visas for two September 11th hijackers arrives months after they died in the attacks.
For Wednesday, March 13th, this is All Things Considered.
The INS embarrassed by the mistake, but critics say there are big problems.
1,600 National Guard troops to patrol U.S. borders with Canada and Mexico.
Plagiarism in the news again, this time, good heavens, on the part of clergy looking for sermon material.
The insanity defense in Texas and the verdict on Andrea Yates.
And moving back to apartments near Ground Zero.
It's very personal to me because who were those people? They were the loved ones of people like you and me. That could have been us. And that's always the bottom line for me.
Those stories after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush told reporters at a White House news conference today that the United States has every intention of consulting its allies about Iraq. The president called Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein a problem. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Vice President Dick Cheney currently is in the Middle East discussing the next move in the U.S.-led campaign against terrorism. That includes Iraq, which President Bush mentioned in his now famous Axis of Evil statement about countries developing weapons of mass destruction. President Bush says he's deeply concerned about Iraq and its leader, a man he says is willing to kill his own people.
He is a problem, and we're going to deal with him.
Mr. Bush says Vice President Cheney currently is reminding people in the Middle East of the danger posed by Saddam and the need for cooperation in confronting him. The Bush administration says it favors a regime change in Iraq, but has not said how it might be accomplished. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate has rejected stricter auto fuel economy standards in favor of a proposal that was favored by the auto industry. Senators turned down the Kerry-McCain plan, which would have required automakers to produce vehicles that get 36 miles per gallon of gasoline by the year 2015. The measure was designed to counter a steady drop in the average mileage of American vehicles, due in part to the popularity of sport utility vehicles. Instead, senators chose a measure co-sponsored by Michigan Senator Carl Levin, which calls for the Department of Transportation to study the matter before issuing new fuel economy standards. President Robert Mugabe has been declared the winner of an election in Zimbabwe that Western governments maintain was neither free nor fair. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Johannesburg.
Consensus from the United States and Europe is that balloting, which conferred a fifth term on Robert Mugabe, was fraught with intimidation and dirty tricks that disenfranchised thousands. President Bush said Washington does not recognize the results. Mugabe was unapologetic about the outcome that extended his 22-year rule, with aides pointing to African countries that declared the vote free and fair. But opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai said people were seething inside Zimbabwe. While he did not spell out the opposition's next steps, he said it did not want a confrontation. There are indications that Mugabe knows there is dissatisfaction in the land. A buildup of military presence in major cities is reported underway, and Amnesty International says it bears close watching. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Johannesburg.
At his news conference today, President Bush said the United States does not recognize the legitimacy of the Mugabe election. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 130 points to close at 10,501 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 35 points, or 1.8%, to close at 1,862. This is NPR News. Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta said today that the U.S. government will continue to provide emergency insurance for airlines for another 60 days. The government began paying for the airline's third-party war risk liability shortly after the September 11th attacks. That coverage, which cost more than $50 million, would have expired on March 20th. Mineta said his department is studying whether the airlines can get adequate insurance coverage from private carriers. A new study finds the epidemic of obesity among this nation's youth has led to a dramatic increase in the number of children with a condition that usually precedes diabetes. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports on the study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine.
Researchers from Yale University tested 167 children between the ages of 4 and 18. They found one-fourth of the children could not properly metabolize sugar. This puts them at great risk for developing obesity-related diabetes. Until now, it's been thought that this type 2 diabetes didn't occur until middle age. If children develop diabetes so early in life, they could develop severe complications prematurely, things like heart disease, kidney problems, and blindness. Researchers point out that weight loss and increased activity have been shown to dramatically decrease diabetes risk among adults who were prone to the disease. They suggest the same is likely true for children. Patricia Naimond, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Americans started spending a bit more freely in February. The Commerce Department said consumer spending grew by 0.3%. The increase was smaller than many analysts had been predicting. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.